Today is Monday, April 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. As the fight against the coronavirus continues, how are things progressing?
I think that in most places we have seen a flattening of the curve.
Plus, concern grows for healthcare workers as they stay in the front lines of the pandemic.
In some countries, there are reports of up to 10% of health workers being infected. This is an alarming trend.
And the dangers journalists face in Africa. Those stories and more are next. Spain is loosening some of its coronavirus restrictions Monday, with workers in the manufacturing and construction sectors allowed to go back to work. With the threat of the spreading coronavirus still present, companies are required to provide employees with protective equipment and make sure they maintain the recommended 2 meters of spacing from other workers. Spain has been one of the hardest hit countries, with more than 165,000 confirmed cases and 17,000 deaths. Much of the country has been on lockdown for about a month. The balance between how long to keep in place stay-at-home measures and when to send people back to work to restore economic function is one that's being weighed by governments all over the world. And to get a better idea of where things stand with the pandemic, I earlier spoke with Dr. Runjun Misra.
I think nationally, we were supposed to peak yesterday. We'll find out later today how those numbers are looking. But I think as a nation, most of the states have a shelter at home in place, which has really helped. The social distancing, the stay at home, people have been abiding with that, and it has really helped to decrease the spread. And it has in most places, and I say this cautiously optimistically, but you know, I think that in most places we have seen a flattening of the curve because we're not utilizing the maximum number of resources in the hospital, which is, you know, one of the main things that we wanted to accomplish, as well as decreasing the number of deaths. So I know that there are some states which are currently peaking. I think, you know, in the next couple of weeks, we'll have a better idea because most of the states will be past their peak. But I think that the mitigation strategies we were trying to employ for the last 3 weeks are finally working. And we're seeing evidence of that. So it is promising.
There's a lot of research going on regarding COVID-19 and the SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus, whether it be information related to the actual coronavirus, possible medications in therapeutic sense. What should our listeners be taking a look at as they go through the news feeds as the development on the scientific front of research that's taking place?
A takeaway point I really want to stress to our listeners is that, you know, we're really trying very hard as a global community to come up with, a vaccine for this virus, and then number two, to figure out if we have any current medications that can be used as a viable treatment for COVID-19. However, as we stand right now, there is only anecdotal evidence for all the medications that we have available to us in the treatment of COVID-19. So I know that there are a lot of people who have been trying to take some of these medications without proper physician supervision. There have been certain cases where people have taken higher than usual doses of chloroquine and they have had bad outcomes. They've had some, you know, cardiac arrhythmias, which is very unfortunate, but unfortunately that is a side effect of the medication. So what I'd like for everyone to remember is that these medications are, you know, very real medications with real side effects. These are not medications that we can play around with without physician supervision and without proper indication. So if you are hospitalized and severely ill with COVID, as you know, as a last resort, we are trying these medications to help our patients get better in any way possible. But that's what it is. There are medications that should be used in the hospital and not independently without any supervision.
One last question. There has been some discussion from Dr. Fauci and other healthcare professionals that this could be a seasonal type occurrence. What is the research that you're aware of that may shed some light on that?
Well, I think we're still learning about this, but if we don't get COVID-19 controlled on a global scale, and this is not just about America, but if we don't control it on a global scale, and it may come back as a seasonal infection like the flu does every year, and that's because we do have so much movement globally between all the countries in the world. And if we don't control it in every country to a certain degree, then it has a chance to spread and come back every year.
Runjun Misra is an internal medicine physician practicing in the San Francisco area within the United States. U.S. President Donald Trump has signaled his desire for economic activity to return to normal as soon as possible. His administration has advised people to stay home if they can through the end of the month, while the governors of most of the country's 50 states have gone further and ordered lockdowns with exemptions for activities such as exercise and grocery shopping. As of early Monday, there were 1.85 million confirmed cases worldwide, with 114,000 deaths, according to a Johns Hopkins University statistic. The United States accounted for more than 550,000 of those cases. The World Health Organization is expressing alarm at the large number of healthcare workers becoming infected by the deadly coronavirus. The UN Health Agency is appealing for international support to provide healthcare workers with the supplies and other tools needed to keep them safe. Lisa Schlein takes things from here.
WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says every single person has a role to play in ending this pandemic. Among the major players in this grisly drama are the frontline responders, the healthcare workers who tend to the sick and dying. While they are putting their lives on the line to save others, Tedros says health workers are not getting the support they need to keep them safe.
In some countries, there are reports of up to 10% of health workers being infected. This is an alarming trend. When health workers are at risk, we're all at risk.
Tedros says some health workers become infected outside health facilities in their homes or communities, but the majority are being infected within health facilities where they are exposed to the deadly virus throughout the day. Many become sick, he says, because they are not sufficiently trained or lack experience in recognizing COVID-19 and dealing with respiratory pathogens. He adds long hours tending to sick patients and lack of rest also can weaken resistance to the virus.
However, the evidence also shows that when health workers wear personal protective equipment the right way, infections can be prevented. That makes it even more important that health workers are able to access the masks, gloves, gowns, and other PPE they need to do their jobs safely and effectively.
A new United Nations supply chain task force has been set up to ease the equipment shortage. Tedros says WHO and the World Food Program will be coordinating this effort. He says the supply chain may need to cover more than 30% of the world's needs in the acute phase of the pandemic. To meet this demand, he says well over 100 million medical gowns and masks, respirators, diagnostic kits, and other essential equipment will have to be shipped every month to areas most at risk. The storing and shipping costs, he says, are about $280 million. He notes the cost of procuring these supplies will be much greater. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And coming up later,
there are in jails that, are overcrowded, where there are underlying health conditions, where malaria and TB is a problem. So really, their lives are at risk.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study published in the journal Science suggests that South American monkeys are descendants of ancient primates from Africa. The study authors, led by Eric Seifert of the University of Southern California, analyzed four fossilized monkey teeth that were discovered deep in the Peruvian Amazon about 5 years ago. From their research, the authors proposed that some 34 million years ago, these prehistoric primates made their way across the Atlantic Ocean from Africa aboard rafts of vegetation that were severed from coastlines, perhaps in the midst of a storm. The researchers say the fossilized monkey teeth came from a recently found species they call Ucayali lepithecus perdita. They propose that this ancient monkey species may have been very small and similar in size to today's marmoset. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Thousands of displaced Syrians have begun moving back into their homes in war-torn Idlib province despite the risk of renewed conflict, some driven by the fear that the new coronavirus could wreak havoc on their cramped camps near the Turkish frontier. Reuters' Libby Hogan has more.
The choices are grim for Syrian refugees. Either remain in tightly packed camps near the Turkish border where the coronavirus could spread like wildfire, or return to the war zone they fled from in Idlib province. With a mattress and belongings piled high into the back of a truck, Syrian man Zakaria Shawish is one of the displaced who chose to take the winding road back into Syria.
The living spaces in the camp are overcrowded. We grew worried of diseases, so we decided to come back to our town. Thank God. We pray that we are safe here.
While the blossom is starting to flower in the countryside, the risk of renewed conflict looms. About 1 million Syrians fled Idlib and its surrounding countryside in northwest Syria over the past year, after Russian-backed government forces stepped up a campaign to retake the last rebel stronghold after 9 years of war. Fighting has calmed since March, when Turkey, which backs some groups opposed to Syria's president Bashar al-Assad, agreed to a ceasefire with Moscow. Since then, relief agencies estimate over 100,000 have returned to Aleppo and Idlib countryside. Syrian man Omar Mustafa is one of them.
We returned to our towns. We fled from the coronavirus. Our towns don't really have it. This is springtime. So in the village, the air is fresh and clean. It's quieter than the town. There are no crowds, no smoke. Yes, this is a remote area. And yes, it is dangerous. But there is nothing we can do about that.
Syria's northwest does not have a confirmed case of coronavirus, but doctors fear the area's ravaged medical infrastructure would quickly turn any outbreak into a humanitarian disaster.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. As the U.S. installs missiles near key military installations in Iraq, the country's third prime minister-designate since December says his top priority is to defend the country's sovereignty. Edward Duranian reports that unlike previous unsuccessful prime minister designates, this one appears to have the backing of most of the country's fractious political parties.
Iraq's new prime minister designate, Mustafa Kazemi, the country's intelligence chief, met with top members of the outgoing government Saturday in an effort to put together a new cabinet quickly amid a rare level of support by the country's political establishment at a time of serious internal and external crises. Amid reports, the U.S. is deploying missile batteries to protect several key military bases against threats by Iran and its proxy militias. Kazemi also appears to enjoy the support of Tehran and its local allies. Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that Kazemi is a personal friend of Iran's national security advisor, Admiral Ali Shamkhani, one of Tehran's two point men on Iraq since General Qasem Soleimani was killed by a U.S. drone strike in early January. Abu Diab said Kazemi is probably not the U.S. first choice to be Iraq's new prime minister, but that Washington has had fairly good relations with him in the past and probably is prepared to live with his nomination. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo proposed earlier this week that Washington and Baghdad hold a strategic dialogue in June to discuss the presence of American forces in Iraq. Kazemi told Iraqi TV Friday he would be a stickler for defending national sovereignty. He says Iraq's sovereignty is a red line and he would not be flexible about it. Iraqi sovereignty, he insisted, would not be a subject for debate, and that Iraq's destiny is in the hands of its people to whom it belongs. Kazemi insisted that no one outside the government should be allowed to bear arms, but he left a loophole by confirming the country's Shiite popular mobilization units, known as Hashd al-Shaabi, is a government entity. The U.S. has placed a $10 million bounty on the head of Sheikh Mohammed Kawsarani, head of the pro-Iranian Iraqi Hezbollah militia, which is part of the Hashd al-Shaabi. Washington suspects that Kawsarani is responsible for past attacks on American forces inside Iraq and also is preparing fresh attacks. Given the precipitous recent decline of oil prices due to the effects of the coronavirus on the world's economy, Iraq, a major oil exporter, is facing serious threats to pay its civil servants, in addition to meeting the many demands of protesters for better public services and less corruption, among other things. Dr. Paul Sullivan, who is a professor at the U.S. National Defense University, tells VOA that Kazemi is a tough and smart fellow, and as a veteran intelligence agency chief, likely has files on everyone of note and could call on those files to pressure people to toe the line. But trying to create a peaceful and stable Iraq, he adds, may be one of the toughest jobs out there. If the economy and jobs don't turn around, even the toughest people cannot keep the country together for long. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
As the coronavirus spreads to all corners of the African continent, advocacy groups are calling for the release of a particularly vulnerable group. VOA's Salem Solomon has that story.
As coronavirus spreads to all corners of the African continent, advocacy groups are calling for the release of a particularly vulnerable group, jailed journalists. In an open letter to 10 African heads of state, the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, and 80 other press freedom and human rights groups called for the media professionals to be released.
There are in jails that, are overcrowded, where there are underlying health conditions, where malaria and TB is a problem. So really, their lives are at risk here. And many of them are actually haven't even been convicted. They have been sitting in detention for years without trial.
That was Angela Quintal, CPJ's Africa Program Coordinator. In a survey conducted at the end of 2019, CPJ found that at least 73 journalists were in prison in Africa, including 26 in Egypt, 16 in Eritrea, and 7 in Cameroon. Some of the Eritrean journalists have been imprisoned since 2001.
Certainly when it comes to journalists who are being held there, not because they have committed a crime, but are being held because of their journalism, it is necessary to ensure that these journalists are not stuck with what we call a death sentence, that their freedom is really now a matter of life and death.
One person who knows these difficulties is Mimi Mafo Takumbo, a print and broadcast journalist from Cameroon. In 2018, she was arrested and charged with reporting false information and undermining state security for a story about an American missionary who was shot and killed in the West African country. Although she was imprisoned for only 4 days, she saw firsthand the squalid conditions in which journalists are held in the country and the lack of basic rights.
This sanitation condition is not a very good one. Like I said, the situation of overcrowding in prison, access to your lawyer sometimes is problematic. We've had colleagues who are behind bars and they'll have to spend several months even before having access to lawyers. Others, their lawyers do not even know their whereabouts, like Samuel Wazizi, who is in the Southwest region. Up to now, we are even scared that he's not even alive.
Takumbo says she believes it is wrong for journalists to be held like this, not only on moral grounds, but also because they play a vital role in covering the coronavirus crisis.
They have a huge role to play at this point in time in informing the population and giving them what they need as far as steps towards curbing the spread of coronavirus is concerned. But if most of these journalists are behind bars, who is going to tell the story?
Tukumbo says she hopes her country and others that continue to imprison journalists will see information and those who report it as part of a solution to the coronavirus, not part of a problem.
Release them so that they can be able to do their job. The place of the journalist is not in jail. The place of the journalist is on the field, telling the story, keeping people informed. And at this point in time now, they are needed more than ever before.
Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
Several Dutch cellular broadcasting towers have been damaged by arson or sabotage in the past week by opponents of a rollout of a new 5G telecommunications network. Reuters' Emer McCarthy has more.
A Dutch newspaper reported on Saturday that several cellular broadcasting towers across the Netherlands have been damaged by arson or sabotage by opponents of a rollout of a new 5G network. De Telegraaf said there have been four incidents in the past week, citing the director of the Monet Foundation, an industry group that oversees placement of cell towers in the country. De Telegraaf reported that arsonists had left an anti-5G slogan spray-painted at the scene of one attack. A range of groups in the Netherlands have been opposed to the introduction of 5G for some time, mostly over concerns that radio waves could damage human health. Others fear the technology could infringe upon privacy. Major telecommunications providers in the Netherlands are in a testing phase with 5G and have not yet begun a nationwide rollout, pending a spectrum auction due to conclude in June.
That was Reuters reporter Emer McCarthy. As people have isolated themselves to avoid the spreading of the coronavirus, many are continuing their social lives online. The video conference, once the realm of corporate meetings, now acts as a lifeline for communities desperate to connect. Matt Dibble has a look.
On most mornings these days, Madison Kiesler and Benjamin Fremantle make a light breakfast and head to their living room to practice with dozens of other members of the San Francisco Ballet Company.
We go side.
Since shelter-in-place rules went into effect, the company has met by video conference. For Kiesler, a soloist with the ballet, the disruption of her community was challenging.
Ballet company in particular, the people you work with, and especially the dancers, they become like family. So at least this offers waking up, turning on your computer, and you still get to chat with them and see them a little bit.
On screen, a grid is filled with 18 dancers performing alone in their kitchens, bedrooms, and other unusual places. Since the company began sharing these sessions online, fans around the world have had an intimate look at the dancers at work and are even joining in. Principal dancer Benjamin Fremantle likes this unexpected twist.
People really want to know who the dancers are, and you just don't get to know that on stage. So even just this little glimpse into your living room or something, where I think you get to see a little bit of who that person is.
Old friends are also connecting more often by video chat.
Best of luck to Laura.
Thank you.
Lexine Alpert felt compelled to reach out to a group of women she's known since the early 80s.
Normally we have a gathering about every other year. Now we're doing it once a week on Zoom. It was a really nice time to hear everybody's take on how they're handling the situation.
Alpert also meets with several other groups each week.
My book club, we're also doing Zoom calls over dinner or glasses of wine. It's just a way to stay connected to one another.
Filmmaker Louis Schwartzberg had spent months generating buzz and cultivating an audience for his documentary, Fantastic Fungi, selling out theaters in the U.S. and Europe for the planned release date of March 26th.
Fungi generate soil that gives life.
When theaters were forced to close, he had to quickly come up with a new plan.
We pivoted when we heard about this pandemic because people could no longer come to the theater, and we really wanted to continue this feeling of connection.
The solution was a virtual release. People could watch the film at home and participate in live discussions on Zoom with Schwartzberg and members of the cast.
It was amazing. Probably got 20,000 attendees and participation from 101 countries.
What can mushrooms teach us at a time like this?
Well, the communities survive better than individuals.
And during the pandemic, technology is playing a vital role in sustaining those communities.
Thank you.
Matt Dibble for VOA News, San Francisco, California.
And that'll do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.